Welcome to our most recent podcast series, Collective Intelligence. At a moment when the shape of work is being redrawn, we seek to explore the magic that happens when groups perform at more than the sum of their parts, a theme we researched extensively in our book, The Social Brain, The Psychology of Successful Groups. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Robin Dunbar, Emeritus Professor of Evolutionary Psychology at Oxford, and perhaps most importantly, co-author with myself and Sam Rocky of The Social Brain, The Psychology of Successful Groups. Robin, it's lovely to have you all to myself, to have a chance to reflect with you on both on the ideas behind our book and why it's found its moment. Welcome to our podcast.
Oh, it's great fun to be here.
So if I could begin, I suppose, as all good podcasts do, and go back to the beginning. I know we came together originally because we'd all three of us been really interested in why it is that some groups gel and thrive and some groups simply don't. And I wonder, what was the spark originally, back in the mists of time, that got you interested in that question?
Well, really back in the mists of time, it was actually trying to understand the evolution of social life in monkeys and apes, which is what I worked on back in the day, studying monkeys in the wild in Africa. One of the things that came out from that was different species had limits on the number of animals they could have in a group size, if you like, that seemed to be correlated with their brain size. And having discovered this, clearly very late one evening probably, it occurred to me that, well, we could plug humans into this same relationship and see what kind of predicted group size we might get out for humans. And the answer came out very quickly as being about 150. And I spent a lot of time after that burrowing about in libraries trying to see whether humans really did live in groups of 150 or not. But that was the essence of it. It once we discovered this relationship in humans, I'm afraid it acquired a life of its own. And I spent the next 25 years trying to understand humans rather than monkeys and apes.
I want to come back to scale. And certainly from my perspective, I became very interested in numbers, not necessarily 150. And I know, you know, you explore the significance of all kinds of numbers in the Dunbar graph. But when I was putting together leadership programs, so putting together groups of people for a very short period of time, I noticed that if we got beyond a certain size, the group split into two. And I think that's, you know, actually where we began talking to each other, wasn't it? The kind of, yes. Why is that happening? What is it about scale? But we'll come back to that. But I wanted to bring us back to now. And I know a couple of weeks ago, you were in the Drucker Forum with Sam. And I was interested, not being there, eating cakes in Vienna with you two, but I was interested in how you felt our book kind of struck a chord with the audience there, whether you felt like actually this was kind of a moment for the ideas that we're talking about here.
I think it did strike a chord. There was a great deal of discussion in many of the sessions really hovering around how we should work. And I think rather than the numbers per se, the bigger picture of, if you like, the organization, the business as a village of people who know each other and interact on a daily basis, and how to manage that in an era when you have hybrid working and half the people aren't there. That really was a kind of substantive issue that was buzzing about under the surface of all the discussions in many ways. You know, in the background of that, of course, is precisely these grouping sizes that become important. But maybe we can come back to that in a minute. But I think the real issue that sort of where the book collided directly with what people were really concerned about was in the nature of the organization, the business, the department, whatever it might be, the hospital, as a living, breathing village of people who have to get on in order to achieve what they've got to achieve, because what they're engaged in, whether it's providing a service of some kind, like a hospital or perhaps a school, or making something, a product to sell to people, the effectiveness and efficiency with which the organization does that really does depend on how well everybody works together. And if you like, I suppose the bottom line here is help each other out. But also there's an element of creativity that goes on mysteriously and magically somehow when people casually put their heads together. And that's very important. Of course, if you're not in a central place of work, that's not going to happen so easily.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I think you're right. I think this is a moment where people are really grappling with getting the shape of work right. And it is tricky for people. You know, this wonderful, look, here we are, goodness knows where you are, in the Wirral or something, and here I am in London talking to each other. And of course, it's magical. It's brilliant. But that sense of what's the right balance, when do we need to come together? And I like the way you talk about sort of villages. And yet what we encounter a lot is that many people are working virtually in groups or teams, often back to back, meeting to meeting, that are too big. They don't feel like they're working in villages. They feel like they're working in sort of vast metropolises and they're kind of just a speck. And I think I've always been interested that actually the size of a team is often not really thought about. People don't really think about it. They think about talent. They think about who's the right person, who's going to lead it. But they don't really think about what's the optimum size for a team. And I'd be interested just to hear you talk a little bit about some other numbers apart from the Dunbar number and why they are particularly effective.
Yes, and I think that whole issue of group sizes, as it were, is, of course, sitting right at the bottom of this whole issue of hybrid working and how we organise ourselves in businesses and organisations, because actually the numbers are the key. Now, what turned out, I mean, it took a long time to discover this actually, was that these kind of group sizes that we see as natural group sizes, so in monkeys and apes, the groups, social groups that they live in humans, let's say the size of our natural personal social networks, the number of people that we know and have meaningful relationships with, sometimes the size of actual organizational units. And that number in humans is this number 150, the Dunbar number, which is much, much bigger, three times the size of anything that you see in the most social of monkeys and apes. Is not actually a single monolithic number. It turns out that it's a kind of layered series, a little bit like the ripples on a pond. If you imagine yourself as the stone thrown into a nice, calm alpine lake, and the ripples running out from the stone represent the structure, really, of your social network, and indeed the structure of almost any organization. Obviously, you have some fairly small ripples right near to you, and they tend to have a high wave, a big wave. And as they go further and further out, they include more and more space. In other words, more and more people. But the kind of height of the wave gets lower and lower and lower till it eventually peters out. And that really stands as a metaphor for the closeness or quality of the relationship with the people in that particular circle or ripple. So it turns out that these layers that we see in not only human social groups or personal social networks, if you look at the traffic, the frequency with which people phone or text each other or post to each other on Facebook or whatever it may be, you see a very distinct pattern. And that pattern actually occurs in monkey and ape groups as well, but of course on a much smaller scale. But the numbers are exactly the same. They just don't have as many layers as we do. These layers occur at very specific sizes, 5, 15, 50, 150, and then out beyond that, 500, 1,500, 5,000. What's peculiar about those numbers is that they scale with a ratio of three, so that each layer is roughly three times the size of the layer inside it. And I should say, these numbers count cumulatively. So the 15 includes the 5 in the inner core, the 50 layer includes the 15 that sits immediately inside you. So what you're kind of doing is adding new subsets of people who are themselves gathered in these little clusters into your network. You're bolting more and more of these little groupings on in a very distinct way. But that pattern is very characteristic. It has this scaling ratio of three, which you see over and over again everywhere. And it turns out that these numbers are actually kind of optima in terms of information transfer around social networks. So we've shown mathematically that when you have natural social networks of any given size, if they hit these particular numbers, then they're much, much more efficient in terms of the flow of information around the network, how well the members of the network know each other and so forth. And the big one, if you like, is at the 150. The other layers inside that and outside that are sort of really harmonics of that in some way. But, you know, it's very, very remarkable that the efficiency of the network is so dictated by its size and to very specific numbers.
I've been struck, certainly as we've gone around and talked to people, I've been struck by two things. One, how many times people have come up and said, talked about the difficulty of moving in and out of those ripples, as you call them, or indeed, I mean, people have said, actually, how do you exclude people? They've talked about how, yes, our teams are too big, but, you know, we want to include everybody, but they're not productive. And that difficulty of moving in and out of the ripples is actually, I think, a very real one and quite interesting. Yes. And I think the second thing that has struck me, back to your point about the stability of these particular numbers, is how much, you know, if you're talking to an entrepreneur or a startup, they absolutely recognize, for example, that 50 is a point. Yes. And beyond that, there has to be huge structural change. And beyond that, everything feels differently. And quite quickly, you know, you might get to 150 for that. And how they've really reflected on how leadership at different scales also needs to change. So absolutely been fascinated at really sort of coming across the real pragmatic, practical, felt differences of what you're talking about there in terms of mathematics.
That came up very strongly, actually, this transition point at 50 in a study that I was involved in, looking at communities of practice in business. So, you know, little sort of gatherings of accountants across organizations, or little gatherings of HR people across organizations to, you know, engage in, discuss things of interest to themselves. And they come in all shapes and sizes, although they happen to turns out from the sample we had to map onto these 500, 1500 layers very nicely. But one of the things which did pop out, and I thought was completely unexpected, but kind of fits very well with the observation that you just made, is that so long as the community is under about 40 people, let's take the benchmark there, so we're just below the 50, you can run the whole thing democratically, you know, and informally. It doesn't really need, everybody takes a share, and, you know, somebody organizes the room, somebody provides some biscuits with the tea and all these kind of things. People just do it automatically. Once the size of it goes past 40, so now you're in that critical 50 layer, that just breaks down. People start not doing fair share, I suppose you might say. And at that point, you just need a committee, and therefore you now start to need a management structure. You need, you know, somebody to chair it, to get things done. You need sort of some assigned roles to make sure that all these little jobs that individuals used to volunteer to do now actually do get done for the occasion, as it were. So that's a very practical example of that thing, this thing that CEOs have noticed, as it were, in their own organizations, actually turning out to be absolutely right on a quantitative numerical scale.
That's so interesting. And particularly with founders, I think, that moment where they think, it's not the same as it used to be. I used to have it all in my head. And now suddenly we have to have processes and systems. And that sense, in a way, of regret, actually, that, you know, once you get to a certain size, you need to change the structure.
And this goes back to this, I mean, you alluded to it again, actually, just a minute ago. This issue of who do you include in a committee or a meeting. And I think that is one of the things that really needs to be looked at closely. And, you know, to be fair, that's exactly what you and Sam have been doing with a lot of your consultancy work, because there is a sense that, and I see it, you know, even in the university world, you feel obliged to ask all sorts of people to be at a committee on a or a meeting on a particular day about something, because if they are not invited, they might be offended. And the answer is, you know, they should be very pleased not to be invited, A, because it's not wasting their time, and B, it's keeping the meeting size small enough to be able to function efficiently as a decision making body. So this, you know, what you really need to do, I think, when looking at meeting structures, whom to invite, is to look very carefully at who really needs to be there. And I think that kind of goes back to one of the findings that both Microsoft did a big study of their entire workforce during COVID to look at the way in which sort of, if you like, hybrid working functioned, where everybody was sort of video conferencing with each other and so on. And we did another study of an academic institution. And both of these studies basically showed that one of the downsides of you having a hybrid working format where people were meeting virtually was that people spent far more time logged into their virtual conferencing software and staring at a screen, or not staring at the screen, but instead staring out of the window at the cat chasing pigeons on the garden lawn, probably, than they ever did in meetings face to face in the days before. You know, and that's a kind of marker that it's very, very easy for the sort of software, if you like, to run away with you and then become completely unproductive.
We could spend the whole hour talking about meeting strategy.
I know.
I like that real rigor. That goodness, do we all follow it? That everyone in a meeting knows that the story of that meeting would be completely different if they were not in it, and that kind of rigor of what you bring and why you're there. Is one that's attractive in theory but difficult in practice. Yeah, I think I'll just say one more thing before I ask you something else, which is, I think there's also a strategic need for people to think about how they move people in and out of those layers. I mean, as you say, we spend about 60% of our sort of social time with that inner 15. And I think in traditional, more pyramid structures, where the board or the executive team at the top are somewhat kind of static, there can be a sclerotic kind of fixedness to that group, while outside the context changes hugely. And actually building in that kind of connected flexibility of the people at the top, given the different strategic direction of the beast as a whole, I think again is something that we've been thinking about and helping people to think about. I think the numbers and the scale and the limits to our abilities to have infinite numbers of relationships actually helps people to make those decisions. But I wanted to ask you, Robin, and I haven't asked you this question before. I mean, we've slightly dragged you out of your brilliant academic life into
my ivory tower.
In your ivory tower into business and, you know, the world that we spend a lot of time in. I wonder, Has anything surprised you, or I don't know, delighted you or otherwise, about, just bringing these ideas into business as we've been doing over the past 2 years, from your perspective?
Well, from my point of view, actually, probably the most interesting thing has been the way in which these ideas and the numbers and the mechanisms that we've discovered for how villages create themselves, if you like, socially, turn out actually to be quite useful in the world, in the real world of work. For organizations and businesses of all kinds. And the fact that a lot of them clearly understand, a lot of the sort of business leaders clearly understand what the issue is, but can't sort of envision what the solution is and are a bit sort of have their hands tied by the way the system has evolved in the past. So, this is a bit like turning the Titanic round, I'm afraid, particularly if it's a very big organization, to kind of restructure it in any way. And in fact, of course, any kind of mention of the word restructure has anybody in business or real life, panicking like crazy, looking for their life jacket. But the end of the day, I still kind of feel, perhaps because of this inertia in the system, it's taking a long time, and perhaps understandably will take a long time for these ideas to be worked out and applied in much greater depth. Because the issue with them, and I think this is where we and our your approach and my approach and our collective approach in the book differs, if you like, from all the other many books of business advice, business organization, how to succeed in business, all these kind of things, is we're taking an organic, organismic view of the village, of the organization as a village, where, of course, almost all these how-to books are all about how you can improve your performance, and never give a second thought to the fact that actually, whatever you do, bumps up against other people's interests and so on in the village, and somehow they have to be made to gel. I mean, I think that's the important element to it, and it's kind of interesting to look back in some ways, into the history of the growth of organizations over the centuries, because one of the things that did strike me is sometimes how acute the observation of the founding fathers of some of the big multinationals that are with us today, when they set these up, in the 1870s, 1880s, early 1900s, they did seem to recognize that having a kind of workforce that gelled together was important. And one of the things they did was put a social club on the factory site, and people could go. Sports club, pop tennis was very popular, just become very popular in those days. Everybody wanted to play tennis, but they also had debating clubs and other kinds of sports facilities, and you were just a member, and you could go along and share a beer with, the management, and discover that they probably didn't have horns after all, but were interesting people. And so, that sense, they had obviously recognized this as a problem. I think their solution, was a jolly good try, considering, we're dealing with 100 years ago. But it kind of meshes very nicely with kind of the view that we have taken, as it were, in the book.
I think I'd like to come back to that word social, quite a good word. But I mean, for me, it's been surprising and interesting. And I think you're right that what's perhaps different about our approach is that our primary unit of identification is the group or the team.
Yes.
And that mostly people are either looking at kind of everyone or individuals. And I think I have been really interested by the positive response from sports teams that I hadn't kind of anticipated that these ideas would be very interesting to people leading sports teams. educationalists as well, thinking about the thriving of a class of teenagers. Really, they've been interested in some of these ideas about scale, but also how do you create environments within which people thrive? And the third area that I've been surprised and really interested in is essentially people thinking about real estate, thinking about the containers, thinking about offices, the design of them, and how they can actually better accommodate the thriving of groups and human beings. But if I could come back to the word social, one of the things I think that happened almost by default and was not helped by the period of the pandemic was this sort of letting go of the notion of the importance of the social. And by that, obviously, we mean the relational, the connective, and the sort of idea that somehow that will look after itself, that it's outside the carapace of work, that work is about delivering tasks, and the social happens, goodness knows where it happens. But of course, when so many of us are virtual, it's oftentimes not happening. And we know this through the sort of all the in literature we read about loneliness and the sort of atomization of workers and disengagement and quiet quitting and all the stuff. And I wonder, we talk about mental health, we talk about physical health, and we've started together to talk about social health. And I wonder, what your thoughts are about the importance of social health and maybe the simple things that people could do to really reinforce and help the social health of those who work with and for them.
This whole issue of loneliness and the pandemic of loneliness and its consequences that sort of swept over us. I mean, it's not just since the COVID pandemic and lockdown and so on. It was there already, rumbling through the system, and people are starting to notice it. But it does kind of highlight the fact that because we are so social as a species, having a well-balanced social network that you sit within turns out to be extremely important for your health and well-being, much more so than we ever anticipated. So this has sort of emerged out of the woodwork in the last decade or so only, but and it's completely caught everybody left field, as it were. But the amount of evidence now that the single best predictor of your mental health and well-being, even your physical health and well-being, because the two are actually related. If you're going into a spiral of depression downwards, your immune system stops functioning as efficiently as it used to, and you start becoming more susceptible to many of the viruses and bugs and what have yous, and other physical ailments that sort of assault us on a daily basis. And so you end up with people having to take more time off work. It's putting pressure on the people who are having to cover for them. It's inefficient. It's not very good for the business. It's not very good for the workers, as it were. It's not very good for you because you are ending up in your bed, not being very self-productive. And the best predictor of that is simply the number and quality of friends that you have. And now the big issue for people these days, I think, and particularly the amount of mobility we have for work, is that particularly the younger folk, finding themselves thrown into the deep end in a city where they know nobody. The only people they know at work, people at work. So if you take them away from the people at work by telling them to go and work in their bedsits somewhere in the middle of the big city, you're basically taking them away from their natural social environment. So I think the issue that we come back to very quickly is how do you make the place of work a more engaging social environment that will cause people to want to come in rather than stay at home, in order to engage socially as well as productively for the purposes of whatever work they do. And that really, in many ways, is the key. And I think the big contrast here, and you kind of alluded to it just now, is that we've had this tendency to see people as cogs in a machine, and one cog is as good as any other cog. So, you know, if somebody wants to leave, well, fine, we just slot some other cog into the machine in their place, as it were. When in fact that's not necessarily the case. The machine works effectively if it's well balanced and well oiled. And that's the social component. And if you don't get that right, you're going to have a very clunky, I mean, the machine will do its job, but it will be very rusted up and work extremely inefficiently and unproductively. And I think the lesson clearly is, if you want to stay ahead of the competitors, then you really need to look very closely at your social environment at work in order to make it function so that people can build up, friendship relationships. It doesn't mean to say they have to be best buddies, but they at least have to know them well and learn to trust them. And that's the key to it as much as anything else. But you can only do that in a social environment. You can't do it online. It doesn't work. And you certainly can't do it if you stay at home. So you kind of have to do it in a face-to-face environment. So how do you provide a context in which that can happen naturally and organically? And it's not an easy problem to solve. And I think, you know, that's one of the things we've angsted about a great deal in the course of writing the book is, you know, what should you do? And it's one of those cases where you kind of go, well, there is no silver bullet solution to everything. You have to titrate your solution to the particular context of the organization. But it's all about having, I think, people, and it just goes back to who should you have on your in your meeting group round the table. And the answer is, well, of course, people who have a direct stake in or something to contribute to the particular problem in hand on the day, but also it helps enormously if they are all on the same page. So you don't have to explain everything to them. And that's what having these kind of relationship networks, let's perhaps get away from the word friendship, because it perhaps implies too much hand in pocket, as it were, but positive, trusting relationships with the people you work with, it is really dependent on your seeing yourselves as a collective, as a group, as a village who are engaged in a common project to which we all feel a sense of obligation to do our best for.
Yeah, I think that's so, so important. I mean, I'd like to move away altogether from, you know, the metaphor that never goes away of the organization as a machine.
Yes.
And I, you know,
dreadful.
We are messy, you know, human beings with all our brilliance and all our difficulties and so on. And I think one of the things that the most prescient organizations now are starting to do is actually design social strategies. You know, who do we need to, how do we need to bring people together? As you say, that, you know, that need for trust, for relationship. I mean, if you're going to innovate, if you're going to perform, if you're going to take risks together, it's very, very difficult without that bedrock. Of course, if one's just going to execute the same old tasks again and again and again, perhaps it is more efficient to stay apart. I want to come back to, quite often people say, well, what you're saying is sort of obvious. It's kind of intuitive. You know, kind of we all know this. We kind of know.
But we're not doing it, Tracy.
We're not doing it. And when I design kind of learning weeks, I spend a lot of time designing the spaces in between the sessions. And it's something about how do you make the space between us, the relationship, visible to people. How do you make them see it? So we work quite a bit with Chris Thorogood, who's the deputy director of the Botanic Garden in Oxford, and he said people are plant blind. They just see green. They don't see individual plants like they see individual faces. And I feel that people don't see the dynamics of the spaces in between people in a way that it seems incredible to me. And so as a result, I think a lot of times our organisations and our structures are built kind of to work against the grain of our very humanity.
Yes.
And I think both you and I and Sam have seen that actually it's really, really simple sometimes to work with the grain of our biology, of our inherited psychology, of what we need, of how we thrive, of us as human beings, not, you know, slightly fallen machines. And I wonder, A, why you think people can't see those things or take them seriously, and B, what are the sorts of things we should be doing to be working with the grain of who we are and what we need?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the problem is that we do know all these things intuitively because we live this world 24/7, 365 days of the year. This is the world in which we are immersed constantly in our social lives and in and out of work, of course. But the problem is, because it's intuitive, it's often not obvious how to create a better environment. It's almost as though you're looking for the perfect hostess who knows just what to do, how to engage the sort of various folk at the party, as it were. That's something we're not very good at ourselves. You know, that's why we admire people who are very good at creating a party and making it work. But I think it's, you know, once we understand what's driving the system and how it works, as I think we now have a much better grip on, then it's time that perhaps there should be a component of that in the professional management of people side. So, you know, it should be, in some senses, I might even suggest it, you know, it's an arm of a proper arm of HR. You know, human resources is about managing and facilitating those kind of things. And I think if you don't get it right, the kind of irksome legal stuff that the HR departments have to spend all their time gritting their teeth over will, by and large, disappear into the cracks because people won't be, sort of at each other's throats constantly. So there is a sense in which what is obvious is not obvious on a daily life, and that's been part of the problem. But I think in the end, you know, we are stuck, just as we are stuck with buildings that were built in the 1890s, you know, 19th century buildings in many cases, and we can't do much about the internal and external designs of these buildings, no matter what we want to do, short of knocking them down, obviously, and building something new. But, you know, we're stuck with a kind of inertia, both in management terms, in how organizations have come to be, the particular shape they have and particular structures they have, which had largely been a consequence of trying to grapple with this massive increase in organization size that's happened in the last, really, no more than the last 50 years, or so 50, 70 years, which is, you know, something of the kind we have never seen before. I mean, you know, an organization with 30 or 40 or 50,000 workers scattered around the globe, I mean, this is kind of unknown. In the 19th century, they would have been little pockets that were self-regulating and ran themselves and basically were independent of each other, probably. But now, you know, the management sort of design and strategy and organizational psychology and so on, business organization that's emerged since the 1950s to try and cope with this has been very much, shall we say, infected by this mechanistic model of the workforce in general and how businesses should be, that they are machines with cogs and stuff, rather than organizations or villages that consist of people who, you know, will be rather variable in their particular traits, but, you know, work best if they all work together rather than at each other's throats all the time.
And absolutely, Robin. And there are really simple things that you can do. I mean, we were working with a group the other day, a senior group coming together from all over the UK. And we were told, oh, there's no budget for lunch. And so at lunchtime, everyone disappeared to buy their own sandwich, you know. And the idea that you've got leaders coming together in person to, you know, to build trust, to learn about one another, to be curious about one another, to eat together, creating social endorphins, bonding mechanism, you know, it seemed such a simple thing to do, and such a sort of I don't know, sort of a counterproductive strategy.
Yes. Undoubtedly so, because I think, you know, eating together, as it were, turns out to be one of the pillars of what I refer to as our social toolkit, the behaviours that we use to create and bond communities, for and that we use both in our personal social lives to create friendships, as it were, but also in bonding conventional communities, literally the village, as it were. And there is something about eating together which lets people put their hair down, as it were, and relax and engage with each other rather than, you know, trying to defend their little corner against the onslaught of the rest of the organisation, who are clearly out to get them. You know, that creates those sense of friendships. And of course, there's the very nice example that Sam gave us of her experience working for SAB Miller, the South African brewers, you know, who basically just put a pub in the foyer of every factory and headquarters building, and people dropped in on their way home. They'd have a beer and go home, but they would have that beer with people, and, you know, that gave them an opportunity to meet people from other departments and to discover that actually, well, the people from finance are quite nice.
Yeah,
and it's those, that building of affiliative relationships and trust that is key to the whole process, because if you don't have that sense of belonging, we're all in it together, it's our village, you know, the success of the organization depends on us working together efficiently, then, you know, you're in for a very, very bumpy ride, I'm afraid, in the future history of your organisation, whether that's a government department or a hospital or a business.
And I think that example you give of Sam and SAB Miller, you know, long after the company ceased to exist, the bonds and the connection...
Well, I should hasten to add, it doesn't cease to exist, it's still there, in another guise.
In another guise, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But yeah, in another guise.
But you know, yes, you're right.
Bonds, you know, have lasted and lasted. It's extraordinary.
Yes, yes.
I'm conscious of time. We've lasted long. I've just got two very short final questions for you. You chuckled a couple of times to me after we'd taken questions and whatever, and you said, you muttered under your breath, everyone will be back in the office after 10 years. I know academics hate to make predictions. Do you think we will all be back in the office?
I think the answer is yes. I mean, it still may be a little bit of a hybrid thing, but my reason for saying that is we've actually tried this before in the late 90s, early 2000s, when it was done to try and reduce big multinationals' rental footprints in very expensive city centres like London and New York and the like. They wanted, you know, suggested, and the technology for video conferencing had just become available, so they thought they could send everybody home with their laptops to their country dachas and just sort of dial in, as it were. And it was greeted, I think, with a similar kind of enthusiasm that hybrid working has been, but it didn't last very long. I think 3 or 4 years down the line, everybody was back in again. And I think it's that, you know, we spend most of our week at work in one form or another, whether we do it at home or do it in an office or a factory. We spend a very large portion of our time, and to sit in isolation and not be able to engage with people and have a joke and, you know, have a cake and a coffee with somebody just makes the whole enterprise that much more boring. And, you know, these are very often people who are interested in the same kinds of things. And one of the things that drives friendships is what this phenomenon of homophily. We like people most who are most similar to us in their interests and what they do and how they think about the world. And so, you know, to find a bunch of people who actually you've got a lot in common with and would really like to spend an evening perhaps with, but you can't because you're stuck at home and they're stuck at home, so you can't even have a beer over lunch with them, just makes the whole process very irksome. And I think you want to come in. And that was one of the experiences at that time. I remember graphically at a meeting, a workshop on what was then called home working, one of the big multinationals saying that when they'd offered this to their headquarters workforce, this was, the people that complained most bitterly about it, and bitterly did they complain, was the younger 20-somethings who said, but work is our social environment. Basically, you're telling us we can't come in and see our friends.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, if you're young, you need a critical mass of young people.
Yes.
And you learn by watching other people, that incidental learning just from being in the same room with others.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
Is absolutely key.
Learning by osmosis.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. We've run out of time, Robin.
Right.
And I've certainly enjoyed being, I don't know, have we been more than the sum of our parts in writing this book? I think we have.
I definitely think so.
And really enjoying how our ideas are developing here. And thank you also to everyone for listening to this podcast. We will put some links in the notes, in the show notes. And particularly, Robin, it'd be great, I think, to put a link to the piece of research you talked about in terms of how information moves around the system.
Yes.
for groups of particular
Okay.
sizes.
Yes.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.